another. I was just telling the boys, the doctor put me on this new medication thing. Mississippi knows what it is, kind of. But it makes my lungs feel like it's filled with talcum powder. So, pardon me if I start hacking throughout the show. Just tune me out. But welcome to the Meat House. We want to remind folks we're kind of on a different schedule here coming up. We're going to be on hiatus, Ryan, back on June 20th, correct?
That is correct.
After this show. So we're going to take a one-week break and then come back on June 20th. So I want to also remind everybody that the replays, the downloads are always available at the Meat House, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podcastpedia. I think by now you could probably just Google the darn thing and find it just as quickly. So we also do the Facebook thing, the Meat House, and of course we live at themeathouse.com. So check it out. Ryan in the house tonight, Aaron Martin along for the ride, Mississippi, Chris Spencer, Jeff Schaus, all the way from, where are you at?
Alberta, Canada.
Alberta, Canada, of all places. My name is J.D. Webb, and we've got three segments we're going to cover for you tonight. Really excited about the first one. We've got nine different styles or flavors, varieties, I guess, of honey that we're going to taste, courtesy of Worker Bee. We've got a couple of guests with us tonight. Ryan's going to handle that. Second segment, we're going to be talking about the homework assignment that Ryan assigned us last week. As you recall, the cocktail meads that we've been talking about. And in the last segment, I've got a DIY project I want to run by you guys. And Jeff's got some MacGyver-like brewing equipment that he wanted to kind of toss out there for a little bit. But first of all, we need to get some business out of the way. Jeff, he usually cruises around the Facebook thing for us, and I know you found something new this week.
Oh, yeah. We actually had one of our listeners contact us the other day, and, I was the first one to respond, so I had a conversation with a guy, Thomas Ray Jr. Dillon, messaged us about making grape meads. And specifically, he says he's making something with 5 pounds of Ohio wildflower honey and EC1118. And it sounds like what he's going for here is a high alcohol, sweet, kind of heavy bodied sipping mead. What he's referring to as a grape mead or a super mead. And he kind of wanted some input on that from us. I don't know if we want to go into that now, if we want to carve out some time for that in the future as far as a wider segment. I asked him a little bit of information.
Yeah, let's. I kind of followed along with what you were doing there with him on Facebook. It's going to get kind of involved, so why don't we save that for between two and three tonight, between segment two and three.
Sure.
Because I would like to touch on that
get. He goes right along with my cocktail, so that'll go. Yeah. We can talk about it then.
Yeah, there you go.
Well. And the other thing he wanted to throw out there was actually about the cocktails, because I guess last year he made a margarita-style mead, is what he called it, using some orange blossom honey and oranges in primary. Then he added, it was a 1 gallon batch, and he added a whole lemon and a whole lime in secondary, obviously cut into pieces. And said, it took a while for that lemon and the lime to calm down after the secondary, but once it kind of got some age behind it, it came out drinking pretty nicely like a margarita. So he and his friends were drinking some of it over ice, just, like you would on the rocks. And so he wanted to throw that out there, too, as far as that worked out nicely for him.
Yeah, perfect. Sounds good. What else did you find out there on Facebook?
So there's another question I wanted to post to you guys really quickly. Brady Johns threw out a question regarding whether or not people account for the change in volume when they're back sweetening, as far as the change in ABV. So we all have an ABV calculator. You take the starting gravity, you take the final gravity, and you get how much alcohol it is. If you're adding, a pint, 2 pints of honey to the mix to back sweeten after the fact, Do you take that into account when you're figuring your ABV, or do you not?
Depends on if you stabilize. I mean, if you're going to add honey to secondary to back sweeten, if you haven't stabilized it, is it going to fire off again?
This is assuming that we're stabilized and it's just adding volume and sweetness and not, you know, more stuff that's going to ferment out.
Well,
I don't worry about it personally.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would have any effect on the ABV if it's not going to ferment, right?
No. Well,
Go ahead.
Sorry. Like Chris was saying, the dilution factor, it does change it a little bit. I don't know how much, honestly, that I even worry about that. I mean, you guys know me, you know, I like to dry meads, and I think I've made 2 intentionally sweet meads in the last year. So it's not like I'm doing that a lot in the first place, but I don't know that I concern myself that much with it just because it's such a small amount of honey that I'm adding, if any, to back sweeten. But yeah. I kind of wanted to throw that across the table and see what you guys think too.
Yeah, I don't know how it, you know, I mean, I've even read, because I do stuff with alcohol, like, you know, dumping bourbon into my braggots. And I know that adding a whole 750 milliliter bottle of bourbon is only going to raise the ABV about 0.7%. So I don't know what a pint of honey would do to a 5-gallon batch of mead, you know. I don't think
Well, keep in mind that 1 pound of honey in 1 gallon will raise the gravity 35 gravity points. So you're probably not going to be adding more than a pound per gallon anyway. And that change is so negligible, it's not even worth counting. And really, what does it matter anyway? Unless you're having to label your product for sale, I don't really see what it matters.
Yeah. That is another good point.
Yeah. You know, my thoughts are if it is something that is really bothering this person and they really, for whatever reason, it's very important for them to have a very precise calculation of their ABV and they still want that, you know, semi-sweet to sweet mead, I would just increase the starting gravity and intentionally, you know, build your recipe such that you're left with some residual sweetness afterwards, after fermentation is over. Otherwise, I think I'm in the same boat as you guys. I wouldn't necessarily concern myself too much with it if I was back sweetening.
Yeah, and I don't back sweeten, so, you know, hard for me to even, you know, I'm just coming off the top of my head here knowing what I know, and that's it, you know. But I don't generally back sweeten anything that I do, so. Anyway, well, good stuff. Anything else, Jeff?
Yeah, one more quick shout out. There was one from Jeremy Goring that he posted his lawnmower mead, which is what he's calling it's a Rauchbier Braggot. The Rauchbier is a German style that uses beechwood smoked malt, and that just struck me as really interesting. For one, it's a great picture, great beautiful color on this stuff. For two, it's been on my to brew list for quite a while, doing something with that smoked malt myself. So just wanted to throw him a quick shout out because that's really awesome. And yeah, but I'm looking forward to trying something like that myself.
Cool. Very good. And tonight, guys, we're just going to have to forego the what are we drinking, obviously. I got my glass of water in front of me. I hope you guys do too. Maybe we can pick up later on the show. So without further ado, but here's how this whole thing started. So I get this text from Ryan. It might have even been an email. I don't remember which. But he's telling me about this. I don't know. What was it, Ryan? You tell the story.
Yeah, why don't I go back?
You sent me a text about this honey.
You guys ever use Groupon?
No.
No, nobody?
No.
I thought, all right, well, I guess I'm the only one. So I got this Groupon for a family photograph, you know, one of these old-time, old-time photographs. You know, you put on a costume with the, from the Old West or the 1920s or you know, whatever time period you want to do. And I got this thing, you know, for like $5. And 6 months goes by, and I get an email that says, oh, your Groupon's about to expire. So, you know, I get the family, and we plan to meet, you know, at the Mall of America. We don't go to the Mall of America much, but, you know, we headed out there to do this photograph. And then I had met my family there, so they took off one door, and I go out the other door, and I'm walking through the mall, and I see this sign that says honey. You know, on a window, and I walk in, and it's set up. I see about 32 honeys lined up with pump spouts on them. You know, where you can do, you know, a little taste of each one. I don't know if I've ever seen 32 honeys lined up in a row to do a little tasting of that before ever. So, you know, I took a picture of it and I sent it to JD and I said, here's, you know, there's 32 honeys here. In the meantime, you know, the name of the store was Worker Bee. And I met Megan and Michael are with us right now. We'll, you know, get to them in just a moment. And I started tasting, you know, a handful of these honeys. And there was just an amazing variety of everything going on. I think I had honeys from France, Australia, Greece, the Middle East. You know, there was even a honey that had been aged in a tequila, or a beer. I guess it was a barrel that had been made a tequila pilsner. That had been made in that barrel, and then they had filled it up with honey, and it had picked up a little bit of that flavor. But there were, you know, varieties I'd you know, never seen or heard of, and this, if you can imagine this photograph, they go from almost translucent in color all the way to almost opaque. So very, you know, just a huge variety, and I thought this was really cool. So again, I was talking to Megan. Megan was helping me, you know, sample some of these honeys. Told her who I was, and then I came back. I don't know, a week or so later, and I met Michael, who was there, and I picked up this jar of Canadian buckwheat honey. It was just the extremely, you know, barnyardy, you know, dank and barnyardy, and. And I thought that it was going to be perfect to use a Brett with and do some kind of a sour braggot. I got that going last week. I actually did a cocktail of some lactobacillus and some Brett, and you know, so we'll see how that one turns out. Anyway, told him about. I said, love to try some of these, love to get you guys on air, talk about these, have you walk us through what we'll be tasting, what you've got, and do that. So I've got my 9 honeys in front of me. I have not cheated at all as well, so they'll all be new to me. However, I will say that I did taste a couple of these, and then when I went to pick these up, I actually went to Minneapolis and there to the, I don't know if that's an office, Michael, or if that, I don't know if that's open to the public or if that's just your office.
It's a little bit of both. We're kind of by appointment here at the showroom, I suppose.
Okay.
Private honey tasting.
Okay.
There you go. Private. I like that. Private honey tasting.
So, private honey tasting. So I got the try there. I walked in and he had some honey just gotten from Morocco. It was very, very leathery on the finish. There was one that butterscotch type one that I tasted, and then there was one that was how did I describe that? I said it smelled just like hyacinth. I can't say the word, but you guys know the flower I'm talking about. So I had no idea that this was even in Minneapolis, that it was available. Like I said, they got a retail shop at the Mall of America, and then by appointment tasting in Northeast Minneapolis.
We'll go back to regular hours one day.
Yeah.
Hell, I didn't even know you could get carrot honey.
Carrot honey is actually on the second year of the carrot plant when it goes to seed. So a little more technically as far as the agriculture behind that one goes. But yeah, bees can collect nectar from many different flower sources.
Yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, yeah. So what we were going to do here, we've got Michael and Megan with us. We're sitting here. We've got 9 different honeys. Hand-picked by the two of them. They are going to walk us through a little bit of what the variety is, where it comes from, what makes it unique, what will the flavor, the aroma that we'll pick up from it, and then maybe even what non-honey alcoholics use it for.
Is there a particular order that we should have these in, or I printed out that the rest of the guys got that. Ryan sent out a little Excel spreadsheet thing that has the listings of the honeys and apparently where they're from, and then some notes next to it. So I don't know if there's any kind of method to this or how do we
We'll kind of work lighter to more robust flavors and try not to burn out everyone's palate right away here. but thanks for having us. Ryan was correct. I mean, I know that was the whole story on how he found us at the mall. It's pretty good. I hope that the picture turned out well. But really, the honey bar is just a reflection, basically, of what's blooming at what time in what area. So kind of as we move through here, we'll talk a little bit about the area and then the flower mixture and how, you know, the flavors that kind of come out of each individual kind of honey or region.
All right. So which one are you?
All right, sure. Well, let's start with the basswood honey. This is really kind of a late but early season honey from our own hives here up in central Minnesota. The basswood is a prolific flowering tree for a couple weeks every summer. Huge amount of flowers, and the bees go primarily to that. So when we talk about honey being from one flower source or a specific flower source, that's really the predominant nectar involved at a certain time. So it's rare to get anything that's truly 100% one flower nectar, although we can get pretty close. So I'll discuss the first one, and then maybe Megan and I will trade off here as we go down the list. So, not all honeys are very fragrant, but you can give each one a smell. Some definitely come out. But with the basswood honey here, light but quite sweet, and we'll talk sweetness in many forms, but this is like a nice bright sweetness. Very floral, some nice herbal tones, almost to kind of approaches some minty hints too. Very much a bright honey.
Very light in color. It's almost, you could read a newspaper through it.
That's right.
We're talking about the color. Yeah, very light pale yellow. Depending on the weather involved right around bloom, some years you can take on like a greenish tint and more of that mint tone. But this is kind of our go-to honey here at Worker Bee, for your green tea or with some nice cornbread and goat cheese. But I suppose it'd make a pretty fantastic light mead too.
most honeys, they smell like honey right off the bat. This doesn't smell like honey. This I get I get the light floral, herbal, grassy. I don't get the mint though, but
yeah, well, it's more, you get kind of like that raw sort of aroma, or that kind of like almost orchard like, where you kind of smells like where it's being collected, and that to me is more true with the honey. It tends to smell like where it's from versus, you know, if it's from oranges, it's not, doesn't necessarily smell like oranges.
Go ahead, Megan.
Oh, I was just going to say, not to get too technical, but all the honeys we gave you are all raw. So that means they haven't been brought over 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius. So that could be the other playing part in why it doesn't smell like honey. Anything that is liquefied and brought over that 140 degrees has been pasteurized, technically, burning out any of the sugar crystals that are in there, leaving the honey in a liquid form for a longer period of time. So one of the things, too, that we always say is, in the raw form, you sometimes get a better flavor. Anything that's been heated past 140 or held past 140 or that 60 degrees Celsius, it gets kind of burnt tasting in some ways or off-flavored faster. So when you can taste honey in the raw form and fresh, it's better. Honey doesn't really change over time other than crystallization and get a little bit more sweeter. So a lot of times, too, when you get something fresh from that year or the year before and hasn't been blended or mixed or cooked is what's technically the term for it, it sometimes tastes a little bit lighter in pure form, is the best way to describe it, I guess.
Yeah, and with that, you know, if you overheat the honey or even bring it, you know, just up too far, you start to lose all the real nuance of the flavor. So, like Megan was talking about, the flavors aren't as clear, they're not as bright. But since we got a lot of honey, we'll move along to the next one.
Which is Pontan.
I want to throw this around the table a little bit on this basswood. Mississippi, what are you smelling with the?
Well, I kind of get the impression that this is Minnesota's orange blossom honey. I mean, this is sort of this is what you would go to if you wanted to make a mead and you didn't want to showcase the honey, but you still wanted all the body that the honey gives. This would be the one.
Basswood's a little more desirable. I mean, our kind of go-to honey is really more of a clover mixture, somewhere between the Dutch and the sweet clover. And that's fairly common down through a big part of North America, and especially the Midwest. The basswood blooms right before the clover gets happening, so it's arguably a little more desirable for the more grassy floral notes, where our typical kind of mixed clover wildflower, more earthy tones, little nuttiness, a little deeper flavor. This definitely on the high side as far as sweetness and brightness go.
Aaron, did you get your box from Ryan?
Unfortunately not. I think it's still in transit and under investigation.
Jeff, what's your take on the basswood?
Well, this is actually not the first basswood I've tasted before. I have some Wisconsin basswood that was, you know, substantially different. I think actually it has this one has a lot less acid content than the one that I'm used to. But it is a light, very, I get a lot of the floral and a lot of the herbal character to it. So, I could see this working really nicely in like a metheglin using either spices or, hibiscus, roses, some kind of a floral mead. I could see this blending really nicely with that kind of a flavor.
Are we supposed to taste them at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Please taste the whole thing.
Sure. Kind of swirling.
God, stick your finger in it already.
Oh wow, that's different, isn't it? Now I get the mint.
Yeah. See, there you go. Yeah. Honey really is more about taste than fragrance a lot of times. So yeah, don't hold back here.
Well, I don't know how much you know about mead making, but the aroma character of honey is, I'd say, pretty important to our mead making, because the honey In some meads, some of the meads, you'll hear us talk about dry meads. That's where it's just honey and water, basically. A dry mead would be one where the honey is fermented all the way out. So there's no sweetness left whatsoever. What you are left with are the aroma characters that the honey would leave behind. I don't know how much of that would have been based on flavor of the honey. But in a sweet mead, where, you know, some of the residual sugars from the honey are left over, you might be able to detect a honey variety at that point. But this, boy, this is way different.
Well, that's what we were going for.
Yeah, we're going for that. Right. If you've got that was different, hold on here. We're just on number one.
Yeah, I get a strong mint. I get almost a kind of an herbal, and it almost feels like a little bit of heat too, like a little bit of habanero or something. I don't know where that's coming from.
Yeah,
Chris,
that's the acidity. I think you're getting a little acidity in that.
Yeah. Did you taste it?
Yeah, I've always been able to get a little bit of acidity from basswood, some more than others.
Wow, that's different.
I would say this one's a little bit on the lighter side, but yeah, there's some acidity to it.
Very strong. It's got a very strong flavor.
Well, here, why don't we try the second one here as like a point of contrast? So if you, well, here,
yeah.
Turn that to Megan.
Grab the one that says Contant, which is the French word for spring. This one's coming specifically from Quebec. It is their early season honey up there, which is, it'd be about the same bloom as our early season honey down here. And go ahead and taste it. This one is going to be slightly crystallized naturally. That has to do with the glucose and the water factor happening in the nectar source. So higher glucose causes things to crystallize faster. The size of the crystal can vary from something smooth like this to something more closer to crystallization of sugar crystals that you know from your table sugar. This is specifically dandelion and wild cherry. So you're going to taste kind of the buttery notes, almost lemony, start to this. It's going to build up your mouth. The wild cherry is going to hit. And then you're going to get a bitter finish of a back end, just like if you tasted your fingers after playing with dandelions, because that does carry through the honey. So you get kind of a nice beginning, middle, and end finish with this. With some honeys, you don't. The multifloral notes in here are pretty big yet, but it finishes nice, and then you have like kind of a nice mouth after finish feel. It still lingers for quite a while.
Now, which one are we tasting? You broke up on me.
So, Printemps. It should say Printemps on it. Printemps.
Yeah, got it.
And so, this one, too, has a lot of pollen in it as well. So, the smell of it is going to be a little bit more dank musty, for the lack of a better word. It definitely has a fungal characteristic to it, a lot of yeast coming off of it just because it has a lot of pollen in it. It also might dry out the back of your throat because of that as well. Pollen can give you some itchy throat factor after you taste it, depending upon where you're from and how much pollen you normally digest. So just be aware of that as well when you drink water afterwards.
Yeah, I'm getting, when I put my nose into the jar, a lot of must. And or musty, you know, and then as I taste it, it is kind of buttery, and then I find my mouth puckering, you know, as well with it. So it's definitely got some of that tartness. I mean, I don't know, I guess that would, what it would be, I guess, yeah, but I'm definitely getting a little bit of you know, puckering and saliva being generated here, as I would with something really kind of tart.
I'm getting a lot of beeswax.
Yeah.
Especially.
Definitely. Yeah, I'd go along with the beeswax. Very kind of prevalent, and that's probably a combination of the dandelion and then, like Megan said, like a high pollen content in this. I think those two components come together for that beeswaxiness.
Right. The aroma and the flavor are totally different because the aroma is like dirty gym socks.
Very much so.
Well, that, you know, well, very reminiscent of the dandelion itself. I mean, you know, kind of a that grassy, musty.
He's from Mississippi.
Yeah.
Chris is from Mississippi. I get too, Chris. You're not alone.
What do you recommend that this one is paired with or put on?
Oh
gosh.
That's a hard one. I think a good goat cheese would pair quite well. And then I like eating this one just straight.
Yeah,
it's just so good because it's the butteriness of it, and then you already kind of have a lot of flavors going on.
It would go good with I think something more on the savory end of things.
Well, see, I would almost go a little more creamy or something with some like tang to it.
I'm thinking like blue cheese. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of an unusual honey. I mean, to us, sometimes this is just like a breakfast honey, meaning you just eat a bunch of it on, you know, like a carrier, whether it's an English muffin type scenario. I mean, it's kind of a honey that kind of stands alone in a way. But yeah, I mean, it can kind of an unusual honey, and a lot of times, like a really super early season like this, can be really tricky to collect. What's happening in the beehive in the very early season is that the hive is raising a huge amount of new bees. The queen's laying lots of eggs. New bees are emerging, and they're collecting pollen and nectar from the dandelion and turning into honey. But as soon as it's honey, it's getting consumed right away by the hive. So the hive is kind of making it as fast as they're using dandelion honey, at least up here in the kind of northern part of the country. And so it's tricky to collect. You need certain conditions to get into the really good dandelion harvest. So we're always excited when we're able to pull some ahead.
Guys, remember when we talked about making a ginger basil mead? I think that would be the honey to use.
There you go. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Cool. What's next?
Oh, sure. Okay, well, here. We're going to kind of do these next two together. They're both from Kentucky, and one is called Honey Trees, and then the second is Autumn Gold. And really what we're looking at here, an old-time beekeeper, much more of a rich honey, these next two. So what we're looking at with the honey trees, or actually, these two honeys are from the same beehives. And so the honey trees is a reflection of what is blooming at the early part of the season. And then those flowers stopped blooming, and then a new set of flowers took over in the area. And the later season collection called Autumn Gold is the reflection of those flowers. So if you try the honey trees first, you get more of a kind of a bold, caramel, sort of kind of spicy toned honey. And then the second one, more earthy toned, almost to the cotton candy end of things. So really, it's the same beehives again, just different times of the year of the collection. And then if you give them both a smell too, the honey trees really kind of has that almost kind of, you know, bright toffee smell to it.
Yeah.
Where the honey trees, I don't know, a little more earth, but very lightly earthy. Yeah, and they're kind of about the same crystallization where they're firm, but they're not like rock hard. You know, and the honey trees carries a lighter color to it as well, and the autumn gold more of a deeper amber look. which is typically true between early season tends to be a lighter honey, and as we move to the end of the season, we get in kind of the darker honeys.
Light.
There's always exceptions.
What do you, you had something, Ryan?
No, I think that Autumn Gold would make a real nice varietal on its own. It's got some complexity to it. It's got some boldness to it. It's this beautiful amber orangish color. I don't have a lot more to say than kind of just rehashing what we heard here. This is a good one.
I would use this in a light, like an amber braggot, something along a Pilsner, like a Pilsner braggot I just did a while back. I would use this in that. This is really good. I like this. This is that autumn gold.
I would make this traditional one. Either one of these, but the autumn gold reminds me of candy corn at Halloween. Hmm.
Oh, there you go.
I can see that.
I got that.
Yeah, I can totally get there. It's got that candy sweetness going on that comes in kind of after some of that earthy component.
Jeff, what are your thoughts?
Oh, this one takes – the autumn gold definitely takes me back to my childhood. This is like I took a whiff of this, and this smells like, the honey I remember from being a kid. Like the smell is there. The taste is there. It's – before I knew that there were different kinds of honey, this is what I considered honey, apparently.
Yeah.
Nice. And that's really, it's nice that to hear you say that, because that's a common concept that comes up at the honey bar, where you'll try a couple honeys, and then all of a sudden, someone will have one that goes, oh, man, this is from where I grew up, and they'll tell you all about it. So, it's amazing how that kind of, childhood honey taste really stays with you, even if you haven't had the similar flavor in a long time.
Yeah.
But I'm always happy to hear that, too.
That's, either one of these, the honey trees and the autumn gold, I would definitely use that in a light braggot, like I said, along the Pilsner line, lager line type style of braggot.
It's already got that color, too.
Yeah. A braggot, Michael and Megan, is almost like a beer. It's made with beer ingredients, but also incorporating honey into it. As long as you get, what does the BJCP say, Jeff? Harmonious blend.
Yeah, of honey and beer character.
Yeah. That's good stuff right there. Okay, so what are we up to next?
Oh, this is an easy one, cranberry. So people are always very surprised when we get a monofloral or single source honey in, and it is what it is. We don't flavor these honeys. They are literally coming from different nectar sources, creating those different varietals of honey. Some of them that say what they are do not taste like they are. This one is definitely not one of that situation. It's going to taste like cranberries. The flavor or the smell is a little musty again, but it's probably because it's low glucose, or high glucose rather, because this is a very clear, thin, less viscosity honey. It definitely has a – I can't really put my finger on exactly what that smell is. To put it in the bad term is that the honey's been sitting in a bucket for a while with the lid on, and then you open it up, and it's that smell. A little bit of mustiness, but not a bad thing. It's just kind of a
That's the honey aroma that you get.
Yeah.
The aroma is peppery.
A little bit. But the flavor on it is going to taste as if you were tasting, say, like a cranberry syrup. Cranberry honey is not easily gotten, even though honeybees are used in cranberry bogs for pollination. They have to be. Usually the beekeepers are people that are rented out to do the pollination process and not necessarily the farmer owner of the cranberry bog. In this case, it is. So we work with her, and she always has a fantastic crop. So we buy all of it from the specific farmer. So we have lots of this in the store. When you guys stop by for like upcoming convention. But yeah, this is a really fun honey because it's an easy opener to a lot of people that haven't had either a single source varietal honey or anything but citrus, clover, you know, kind of the simpler monofloral honeys that they know. So what do you guys think?
When I first visited the honey bar, this was the favorite one that I tasted. I actually told JD I was telling him I was tasting honeys from, you know, all reaches of the globe. And he said, you know, your favorite's from Wisconsin. I mean, he was making fun of me. But now that he's tasted it, you know, this is one that I think would make a beautiful varietal on its own. Oh, I think that you could layer on some fruit with it for a mel. I think you could also get creative if you wanted to layer something across the wheel with it, if you wanted to do some sort of an herb or a spice. But yeah, this one was my favorite that I first tasted.
I'm using a knife to get the honey out of the jar, and I need something that I can scrape the bottom with now.
I'm using a little bit of bread to pop it up, actually.
Yeah. Hey, guys, take another taste of the cranberry and think about the aftertaste of a green apple.
Oh, yeah, right on the money. Right on the money.
Nice.
Yeah.
Boy, this would go good. This would go good in a sizer. A sizer, apple juice and honey, basically, Michael
red
and Megan.
Green apple. Even.
So how do I get like 5 pounds of this stuff? Oh, my God, that's good stuff.
Wisconsin is known for their, you know, heroic cranberry production.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and it tastes, Chris, I'm thinking like Christmas time, dude, cranberry mead, you know, the sizers, using this in a, you know, apple sizer.
Yeah, cranberry, blueberry size, something.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. I mean, it would also make a super great, like, festive salad dressing, too, there for your, you know, your healthful holiday activities.
Aaron, are you taking notes?
I am. And listening to the discussion here, I just had a question that popped into my mind. You know, if we all think back, cranberry was one of the four honey varietals that I included in that honey varietal traditional meat experiment, yeah, you know, way back when. And I remember one of the comments that I had about that honey. It's just interesting to hear the exact same comment here tonight. My observation was that of the four honeys that I tried, the cranberry blossom was the one that most closely resembled, you know, the fruit that it came from, that, you know, the cranberry tasted more like cranberries than the blueberry tasted like blueberries, or raspberries like raspberries, and so
Amen.
On and so forth. And, you know,
Amen. You know, Aaron, as long as you're talking about that, and pardon the interruption, but you're
sure.
I've had blackberry, I've had blueberry, and you're absolutely right. I've had raspberry. This is absolutely the closest thing to cranberry, more so than the blueberry honey was to a blueberry, or the raspberry to, you know, to a raspberry. So you're absolutely right.
And I was just wondering if maybe part of the reason for that is, you know, just how a cranberry bog is situated, that, you know, maybe the bees, you know, are the nectar that they're collecting is at a higher concentration from that source than other sources of nectar where it's on dry land, you know? So for example, if the bees are
collecting, I think it's going to be really more about the super high concentration of flowers. So like in this case, these bees are right next to, the cranberry bog. I mean, our friend's profession is growing cranberries. So for this harvest, it's very, very much, well, it's almost all cranberry nectar. And the only way to get these really super pure monofloral honeys is if you have an extremely high amount of one thing blooming at one time, which, you know, when you get into the blueberries or like wild blackberries and wild raspberries, you know, you're going to get a relatively large amount of other, you know, native flowers blooming at the same time. But during the cranberry bloom, you get, you know, massive amounts of one thing blooming, and these are pretty much opportunists, so they're going to go to what's blooming the heaviest in one spot. So I think a lot of it is just really the flower concentration involved and the time of the year. So in that central Wisconsin region, there the bees don't have as much diversity of forage as they might, you know, 3 weeks later when we're getting all the flowers and the clovers and the goldenrods and things. So I think it's really kind of more about that than, you know, a particular type of growth habit of a plant.
Or sometimes the varietal. The next one we're going to talk about, too, there happens to be 200 to 300 different varietals of eucalyptus.
Okay, no, wait a minute.
But I'm just giving you an example. I'm not going to go forward with the tasting yet.
Yeah, no.
Just to give you an example, we only use one variety of cranberry to do cranberries, so it's not like you have multiple sources or multiple species of the same flower in competition for those bees. And there's going to be a specific nectar source happening off of cranberries in a very consistent rate. So if you have a mixed varietal of, say corn or, I don't know, anything else that has more than one varietal in the same field, or they're using from field to field, could be different varietals, then the nectar that's coming off of there can also be coming in at different rates, different times of day, and then also have different flavors attached to it. So with cranberries, they're using one specific species of cranberry that's supposed to be, you know, that uniformity that we need in the market, so therefore the bees have also a uniform flavor. In other things, we don't have that uniformity. So when you're talking about blueberries and blackberries and everything else, we don't know what species they are specifically, so you're not necessarily going to get the same uniformity in that nectar source as well, just as a side note.
Interesting. Now, the eucalyptus. Before I even open this thing up, okay, we get eucalyptus. Eucalyptus, if you've ever been to California and if you've ever driven up the coastal freeways, parts of Old Highway 1 and then the 101 freeway, the freeways way back when I was younger were lined with eucalyptus trees because they were massive in size. And they made terrific windbreaks against the coastal winds that used to blow in off the ocean. And so, you know, because there's a lot of agriculture close to the ocean going up the coast. And that's, you know, they would use these trees as windbreaks. So because the problem was it would actually blow the topsoil away. Now, the eucalyptus honey that we get is very medicinal. Because eucalyptus is used in the making of different medicines. I know that. So this is from Tasmania. How different is this going? And I haven't cracked the lid on this. How different is this going to be than from that medicinal eucalyptus? I mean, you take a swallow of eucalyptus honey from California, and it's like a spoonful of Vicks cough syrup, or you know what I mean? It's just got that medicinal thing to it, you know.
Yeah, and you know, kind of to echo what Megan was talking about with the cranberry, eucalyptus is kind of the opposite. There's like 200 to 300 different kind of species of eucalyptus tree. So it'll vary quite a bit depending on the region and the species. The other part, too, soil content would play a part in this. You know, if the soil is very acidic or very salty from the coast, that's going to influence the plant and how the plant takes the nutrients, and then also how they get redistributed in the honey. Ryan, if you remember, there was the honey that you tried at the studio, not at the at the shop there. I had you try a different eucalyptus. Not the one that we're looking at today, but that was the really super butterscotchy one. that was the eucalyptus from South America versus the eucalyptus that we're going to taste here today from Tasmania. And that has to do with the species involved as well as the difference in climate and soil content.
Okay, I'm opening mine.
Yeah, and that one that I tasted was just like butterscotch. I mean, you could have substituted it for butterscotch. I mean, that's how close it was.
We'll be working on getting that one here by the end of the summer. Don't worry.
Have you guys opened up your eucalyptus? This is way different than...
Yeah, so we're going to have a much bigger aroma on this guy than where we've been previously. Definitely some resinous notes, a little bit of that medicinal quality, you know, sort of kind of smells like eucalyptus, kind of a wet forest sort of thing.
Yeah, this has a little bit more dankness than the eucalyptus I've tried before, which was from Malta. It's not quite as medicinal smelling, but it's still kind of, it has that very eucalyptus-y character. You know, you smell it and it's right there.
Yeah, and this one too, you'll notice we've had a number of different honey kind of textures so far. And going back to the specific mix of fructose and glucose or glucose concentrations in the honey, that really affects how firm or how granulated the honey gets. This is another one that just sets up super creamy, very uniform crystals. So it's got a really fine texture going on right now.
Yeah.
I think Werther's original.
This is, I don't know how to describe this yet.
Yeah, it's not quite a mint character, but it has that kind of the little tingle you get of mint on your tongue. It has that same kind of a feeling or a tactile sensation.
Yeah, it's a little bit like menthol, kind of menthol aspect involved there.
Menthol. Okay, I got that.
Yeah, it's got sort of a bready, like a bread crust character to it.
Yes. And I get a herbal, I get that eucalyptus herbal, but not nearly like I would off of the eucalyptus honey that I get here. This is,
That kind of brings up an interesting question too. So, like, when you guys, like, in your local marketplace, like, where are you sourcing your honey from? Are you finding beekeepers to work with directly? Bulk from somewhere? How do you guys find honey make a fair amount of meat, I reckon?
I'll start this one off, and we'll send it around the table. I live in Southern California, Michael, and... a lot of the honey that we get here is going to be your citrus, whether it's tangerine or orange or you're going to have a hard time finding anything around lemon or lime, but mostly it's going to be orange blossom honey, lots of eucalyptus honey, lots of wildflower. I have a friend that is a beekeeper that I get my wildflower from.
Excellent. And, it always seems to taste better too if you know who's collecting it.
and this is raw. I mean, the wildflower that I get is completely unprocessed. I mean, there's bee parts and you name it. And then there's another honey farm, I guess, about 15 miles north of me that I get my orange blossoms. Now they'll also carry cactus. Sage honey, and those come from the agricultural areas of, say, Southern California all the way up to maybe mid-coast. But let's shoot it down to Chris, because Chris is going to have something even more different.
I just generally get all my honey online because the stuff.
But why? Tell them why.
Well, I can only give you my personal opinion. Because of our climate here, anything that can grow does grow, and we have an overabundance of things that produce bitter compounds. Things like pasture thistle and milk thistle and you know, kudzu, anything you can think of that, that produces bitter. And everybody and their aunt has marigolds in their flower beds everywhere. And so it makes a good table honey, like I've said before. But when you ferment it and you remove the sweetness, you're left with something that's extremely bitter. So I tend to just order my honeys when I need them. I'm currently working with a company called Worker Bee to get some of their autumn gold.
We'll see what we can do.
Aaron, let's toss it over to his end of the table. Aaron just recently moved to Georgia and gave up his, of course, he's from, where you were in Wisconsin before, right?
I was, yeah. Kind of my philosophy, and actually it's South Carolina where I've moved, although I've been spending quite a bit of time in northern Georgia. That's where my parents live, actually. But kind of my philosophy has been to look for, you know, local beekeepers and trying to find whatever the local honey is. You know, I think back to my years in Wisconsin, which really is where I did the bulk of my mead making. And, you know, a lot of the honeys that we've talked about here, you know, the basswood, goldenrod, raspberry types of honeys those are all types of honeys that are pretty readily available up there. But it's been fun in the last month or so kind of seeing what's available here in South Carolina. I'm finding a lot of like tulip poplar, American holly, blackberry honeys that are also really, really quite delightful as well. So, you know, when it comes to researching and looking what's out there, certainly Google is a big friend of mine, just getting online and seeing what's out there, and just kind of word of mouth as well. Talking to people at grocery stores and things like that, you can get some tips and recommendations of some good places to find some local honey that way.
Oh, sure. And I would even start at the, I mean, we're getting back into kind of beekeeping season here, in North America, but I would almost start just straight out the farmer's market. Talking to different farmers there, if there's no direct honey producer, oftentimes, certain farmers will just have beehives on the side too. They may not be advertising it, but, I would almost start straight at the farm and see where that leads you. Cause oftentimes you can get really, I don't know, kind of unusual things that are a little unexpected, kind of like the autumn gold, for example. But no, in the Georgia area there, you should find some really fun stuff, especially when we get into like sourwood season, and the wildflower mix there is pretty incredible too. So.
Oh yeah, sourwood. How could I forget that? I got my hands on some sourwood here from upstate South Carolina, and it just blew me away. I mean, that's incredible stuff.
A friend in Mississippi that sent me some.
I got a few gallons sitting around.
Jeff is out of Kansas City. Jeff, where do you source your honey from besides the one I guess not the one in your backyard quite yet, right?
No, that one, pretty much all the bees kept their honey for, you know, making
survival
through the winter, even though they exactly. But yeah, no, I get some pretty light stuff from the farmer's market my wife and I like to go to. And then one of the U-Pick farms that we went and got blackberries at last year also has their own hives. I've tried some of theirs as well. Of course, like I mentioned, I'm up here in Alberta. I'm actually like broadcasting from an apiary with 600 hives. So, most of my small batches this year have been with this honey up here, which is very, it's got that higher glucose content. So it solidifies pretty easily, but it has a really creamy texture to it when it warms up.
Interesting.
Is it like a bright white honey up there?
Mm-hmm. That water white character. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fine honey.
And then Ryan, of course, We know where he gets his honey from.
I get, right now I'm working on, I typically buy in bulk. I find something I like. So I've got a, 5 gallon, 60 pound, bucket of wildflower that I got about from a beekeeper about 30 miles south of Minneapolis. Very, it's got a little bit of a clover quality to it, but very good. I call it a northern wildflower. One of my favorites to work with that I use when I can, but it's not as easy to get here, is a Montana white clover, a high country white clover. I really like using that in a lot of different things I make as well. Then from time to time I'll try something different or unique. I've got a brother who lives in Omaha, Nebraska. And last year, he was visiting a beekeeper that had all kinds of varietals and picked me up a jar of watermelon honey, which was, also pretty good and had a unique flavor to it. I mean, you wouldn't taste it and think watermelon, but it had some good flavor.
Megan, what are we tasting next here? Let me guess.
Sure.
Meadow foam?
Yes, we're on meadow foam. Open this up and just stick your nose right in. This smells very caramely, sweet.
Wow.
If anybody has daughters that play with Barbie dolls, for some reason this smells specifically like the crap they must put in Barbie doll plastic. It's a vanilla, cotton candy, but somewhat kind of a resiny smell to it as well. This is coming from Oregon. It's very thin honey. You can roll it around the glass and it's going to cover the edges very easily. Kind of darker brown in color. And then also go ahead and taste it. It's going to taste like, sadly and strangely, a root beer float that has a lot of vanilla in it with a toasted marshmallow back end. And I'm not making that up. It is literally what meadow foam is kind of known for, coming out of anywhere from California all the way up to the Northeast coast, going into Canada. Northwest. I had to double check that and make sure I said the right thing. This is what we give to kids who say they don't like honey in the store, or adults that say they don't like honey in the store because they will second guess what they know is honey. This isn't flavored. It's just coming from different flowers making this this varietal.
If you were to have a cream soda concentrate, that's what this would taste. That's what it would taste like.
Chris?
You pegged it on the root beer float, but it's also got like a vanilla extract flavor. This is the honey for my s'mores mead that I've been wanting to make.
We'd like some of that when that's done.
This is just wow.
Yeah, that right, people also say, what's your weirdest flavor honey? We get that all the time, because people don't think you can give them a honey they haven't like tasted before.
This is a good place
to start.
Yeah, this is like totally unexpected. I did not expect that flavor at all.
Well, good. We didn't want this to be like a boring honey tasting here.
you don't know what to expect on a lot of these, but I when you smell it and then taste it, it was totally unexpected.
I need a gallon.
We like to exceed expectations.
Yeah, I mean, this is good. I mean, this is great. I mean, I love this stuff.
I need 1 gallon of this.
Well, those 10-ounce jars
it's not
cheap.
It's a rare honey. I mean, to get it with this strength of aroma and character to it. Not a lot of it being collected, at least in this kind of like purity. It's just something that blooms in a certain place at a certain time again. It doesn't really grow well here in the Midwest. We've tried Pacific Northwestern flower for sure.
My wife is sitting here tasting these along with me, and she said if we had a lot of Metafoam, she said she would have to go to Pooh Bears Anonymous.
Yeah. Her and all her friends too, right?
Man, I'm thinking something with rum. Is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking something with rum, wood and rum.
I don't know that I need to put anything with this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I
don't know. Maybe a little vanilla ice cream, stretch out some of that root beer goodness.
I would make a traditional with this, and then soak some wood chips, some French oak, in some light rum, and drop them in for 3-4 weeks. I mean, this is good stuff.
here we go. Metafoam traditional with some raw cocoa nibs. I don't even know if it's going to need a vanilla bean. Maybe a little ginger and allspice to simulate the graham crackers, and you've got my s'mores mead that I've been looking for.
That's it. Good stuff.
Oh, goodness.
Okay, next on the list.
All right, we're gonna do a buckwheat honey here.
Now, is this the one? I don't know if you guys on the crew here, a lot of discussion about when I was doing the other show about buckwheat. There was two different kinds of buckwheat. The one that everybody talked about not using was the one that smelled like the inside of a barn.
Yeah, this is that one, JD.
I thought they all smell like the inside of a barn.
There's
an eastern buckwheat and a western buckwheat, and the eastern buckwheat is very barnyardy, and the western buckwheat is a little bit milder, a little bit more mild. Before we get into this one, this one, when you smell it, when you open the jar, when you taste it, I mean, it smells like a barnyard. It smells like a farm. You'll pick up a lot of that flavor as well. And I had been working, with some sours. I was making a Brett beer. And I had that on my mind. And when I tasted this, I said, I'm going to buy some of this and make a sour braggot out of it. And I started that last week, and I'm going to make a really funky braggot with this really funky honey and kind of go in that direction. So I don't know how many pounds I bought, Michael and Megan, it was 5 or 7 or whatever, how much it was. somewhere between 5 and 7. I started that going, and anyway, why don't we get into the tasting of it?
At least for me, when you, the aroma to me, you get some of that hay and that kind of, varnish quality to it. But for me, it's really more like when you get further into the smell and then into the taste too. But to me, it goes very warm, kind of floral and malty. And then in the case of the taste on this one, it changes quite a bit. Like up front, you get that really big molasses, very earthy tones. And then it shifts a bit and really goes malty, almost to the cocoa at the end. And I think the big difference in the buckwheats that you're talking about has to do with the soil content too. Soil content in the Midwest is very much different than the West Coast. And I think a lot of that is what's kind of changing the flavor of the buckwheat. In this case, buckwheat is usually one of the very last things to bloom, in the kind of the harvest cycle in the northern parts of the states here. So it can be very important at the end of the year for bees to forage at. But oftentimes it's also the very last thing out there. So you can jet you up knowing you got it. But you can generally get a very pure form of buckwheat, which this is.
Yeah, that cocoa just jumped out at me when, you know, yeah. Towards the back end of that flavor. I mean, it's unmistakable cocoa that just comes at you. Yeah.
Go ahead, Cliff.
Go ahead.
Well, I cut you off.
Well, I was getting a lot of molasses, and my wife said it tastes like molasses and biscuit. And that biscuit quality, I started to realize where that's coming from. This tastes exactly like Maris Otter malt extract syrup. I mean, almost identical.
But, yeah, no, that's good. No, I'm glad it's reminding you of something specifically, because that's it's fun to hear too how people describe honey compared to us versus regionality has something to do with it. But anytime we get it, whether it's a mead maker or a beer brewer or a pastry chef versus a savory chef, the way people talk and describe about honey and how they taste it is always kind of fascinating to us. And when you have a couple different honeys in a row like this, it really kind of puts you in touch with your taste buds again in a way that, we don't give them enough attention.
My cousin and I had a small cattle operation up north of Fort Collins back in the early 70s. And we had about 50 acres on our place. He had about 75 acres on his place. And we had them all. We had ducks and chickens and goats and pigs. This smells like all of them. This is very familiar.
I was going to say, because this is really familiar to me too, but this is not a barnyard smell. This is going to sound weird.
Right on.
This smells like.
Let's just say that there's much worse buckwheat in the world.
What this reminds me of? We used to store our oat hay in the barn. And when you've swung the barn door open on, right towards the end of winter, come into spring, and the dew, you had that moisture in the air, and you swung that barn door open, say mid-morning, and this is the smell that you would get. Very much so. This smells like a wet stack of hay to me. Like oat hay. That's what it reminds me of.
Jeff, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, actually, to me, this smells like my ferret. that particular ferret musk, sticking my nose up next to it, giving it a little muzzle. Yeah, that's totally what I smell right now.
A ferret. Wow. I hope you guys, Megan and Michael, you're writing all this down.
I don't know. I mean, it seems a little harsh on the buckwheat critique there.
We'll bring you the really bad ones we've had, and you guys can go to all that one. Wow.
Okay, I mean, needless to say, it's a very polarizing honey, right? Some people are into it, others aren't.
Right.
Well, nobody said they didn't like it.
Right.
Well, I don't know. It's more of like the Guinness of the honey world, it's not for everybody.
Chris was talking about the malt and the molasses. And I agree with Ryan on the cocoa right at the end, but I might try this in a dark beer, in a dark braggot, with some dark grain, some dark malt extract. I would give it a go and see what
Blackberry blossom honey has always been my go-to for a braggot because it has an inherently malty quality to it, but this overpowers it. And I've always had sort of a bad impression of buckwheat, but this is not like any buckwheat I've ever tasted. This is, to me, I'm getting over the top malt character, a very bready malt. So I can see something like an Irish stout, or maybe even some sort of English brown ale, or a Scottish wee heavy or something. This would be one to go to for that, I think.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah, I could see that. And just to chime in, I have always heard the same thing from people about buckwheat honey and steer clear of it. You know, don't touch it with the 10-foot pole type of a thing. And granted, I'm not tasting this one yet, but I did have some experience with a traditional buckwheat honey mead from Misbehavin' Meads, a meadery in Indiana, I believe. And you know, some of the descriptors, the molasses, the maltiness, it was just really, really good. And you know, like it was mentioned earlier, I think some people are into it, some people aren't. But for those of you that are listening that may be scared off from buckwheat, take it from me. It is really an incredible honey for a traditional.
Yeah, don't let it scare you. I mean, you know, it's just got a big, robust flavor. But oftentimes, you know, it's maybe not a honey you're going to sit down on the couch and just eat it. But it kind of depends what you do with it, too. With hot water and lemon, it makes it kind of its own little wintertime elixir. Super fabulous on, like, baked apples with peanut butter, or even with a little bit of chili paste at the end of, like, a carrot green bean almond stir fry. So, I mean, just because it has an unusual flavor, I mean, don't let that stop you from, you know, experimenting with it.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and then we have
They've got to stand up for the buckwheat honey here.
I don't think any of us are saying we don't like it. I mean, you know.
No, I don't.
I'm saying, you know, endearing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. But, you know, it's like blue cheese. You know, some people like it, and some people just, like, you know, can't get near it. So, you know, it's maybe not for everybody. But yeah, don't let that scare you away.
Megan, we have this carrot thing here, and I just popped the top off. So, tell me about this carrot.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of a medium tone brown. It's not so viscous again, but it doesn't have any of the crystallization that we've had in some of the other ones, especially the last with the buckwheat. It's going to be very heavy on the candied notes in the front end, very sweet, almost to the point of this one actually is going to smell like a taste. This is probably one of the few that does. But it also, when you taste it, you're going to get a very vegetal, almost like drinking a V8 if it was carrot based. Celery, carrot, a little bit of a caramelization or a candiedness in the front end, and it's going to kind of follow through to the back end of this. So it's kind of a one note and done, but it's also very different than what we have been tasting. A lot of it is savory, bitter, and sweet. This one's definitely kind of more on the vegetal side. Almost the smell could be reminiscent of like a synthetic rose. Or something like that. So it has a little bit more of a maybe a chemical aspect to it as well, but definitely interesting, definitely different than what we get from a lot of the other honeys. Again, this is a second season thing, so it has to be grown for seed, not necessarily just for carrots, of course, because then you're just getting the root vegetable. So this one, too, it's a little bit harder to get because it is a specialty thing. You have to have pollination to happen to have the seeds. So this one, if the bees are able to forage off of, say, like somebody who's doing it for seed, it works quite well. But, of course, not always able to find it. And this one's coming from Oregon again as well, right?
Yes, correct. Really, apparently all the carrot honey is from Washington and Oregon. I mean, where all the carrot seed comes from apparently now.
Yeah, a lot of the seed farms out here are up in Washington and Oregon.
I want to hear what Mississippi has to say, because I'm sitting here with my bingo card, and I got a word circled that I'm pretty sure he's going to use to describe it.
Well, it's funny because I was sitting here trying to think of a word to describe it. I don't know. You know, there's a tomato quality to it. Did you win?
I don't think that's on his bingo card.
I thought for sure that you were going to say you get a minerally aspect to it.
No, I don't really get any bitter. I get a certain, like she said, a vegetal. There is a celery quality, but there's like a really light tomato, like a cooked tomato or sun-dried tomato or something else. And it's right on the very end. The first is just sweet. But I think this may be the least sweet of all the honeys we've tried.
Sweetness, again, often is like in the taste buds of the beholder.
I think this is the most sweet.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's definitely the most acidic, I think. I'll bet when this was fermented down, it would be very acidic.
Interesting. No,
it's the least floral for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I get the vegetal. I get the vegetal aroma.
Yeah.
And kind of a vegetable. Kind of a vegetable. I don't know if I'd go tomatoes, but I don't know what vegetable it would be, but certainly a vegetal character to it.
Well, I mean, that was kind of why we threw it in here in the mix, because it's just one of those like really small run, kind of just unusual flavors of honey. And it's sometimes you'll find stuff like this at your local farmer's market, just, you know, kind of randomly. The beekeeper pulled something unexpected based on climate or farm change, for example. And I don't know, you can come up with some pretty unusual honeys, you know, and that's, there's always the excitement of honey for me. It doesn't really have any flavor comparison, which is why it's, you know, with like a lot of these honeys, we kind of gave a wide variety of flavor here in a relatively short amount of time.
I asked Michael and Megan when they were putting these together, I said, why don't we, you know, make sure that we cover all corners of the flavor wheel, and why don't we try some things that are unique and different and exotic, and I think that you guys achieved that. I think that and we thank you for doing this. This was unbelievable, and we definitely went across the spectrum of flavors and colors and thick and thin and more pungent. This definitely got it. Before I forget, you know, Megan hinted at it, next week, Homebrew Con in Minneapolis, several thousand homebrewers will be in the Twin Cities all week long. And Minneapolis is also, you've got, you know, I always like to say, I think six to last seven, national mead champions are from Minneapolis on the American Homebrew Association side. And so before I forget, Michael and Megan, tell us where people can find you and how they can contact you.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest way, if you're in the Minneapolis area, our little shop at the Mall of America, first floor across from Macy's, we're open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. And then on Sundays, 11 to 7. If you get a hold of us ahead of time, you're welcome to come by the Honey Studio in Northeast Minneapolis. Generally here a lot, but we'd hate to miss you. And you can check that out at the website. It's worker-b.com. And that's worker-b.com. And that's just the letter B, not B-E or B-E-E, just worker B. Or just use that Google, worker space B usually gets you there. But we'd be happy to see you here. Even since Ryan was in, I don't know, only a couple of weeks ago, several different honeys new on the shelf, local stuff, non-local stuff, good stuff all around, though.
Very good.
So if you have a favorite honey that we didn't discuss here, tell us about it. Tell us about your favorite honey, your favorite beekeeper, and why. We'll try to get them in the honey collection there.
You bet. Chris, you...
we got to talk about three honeys. I got to have some Printips, Autumn Gold, and Metafoam, and we're not talking about some little 2-ounce deals.
Yeah.
Get out your
checkbook. Yeah. I mean, Ryan's got my direct contact. So, yeah, give me a holler. Some of it's easier to figure out than others, but... you know, we might have to get some beekeepers involved for this.
Go ahead.
I did drop Michael's business card into everybody's box. Yep. So hopefully you saw that and didn't throw it away with the packaging.
Yep, you did.
Hey, yeah. or just fly to Minneapolis Airport for like 3 hours, grab the train. It's a free ride from the airport to the mall. Have yourself a fancy honey tasting. And then get back on the plane like 2 hours later. You'll be home before it works out. No one will know you're gone.
There you go. Hey, mead makers tend to use honey by the pound. But absolutely, Michael and Megan, thanks a million for the 9 varieties. And, of course, Ryan for putting this whole thing together. But fun having you guys on the show. Maybe we can do it again with some different varieties next time. Certainly an eye opener for me. So again, thanks a lot.
Hey, likewise. Thanks for having us.
You bet. All right, we're going to move on to segment number 2, and I don't know if we'll even get to the third segment. That was quite a man. I'm telling you, there's some honeys there that I want to get a hold of. Wow. Let's see here. We were going to talk about Ryan's homework assignment and the cocktail mead, right? So, and everybody's made their selection, I see.
Well, just to remind everybody on timing, this is workshop day. So you don't have to have it finalized yet. This segment right here is for you to workshop what you're thinking about. You need any feedback, you need any advice, you want to just talk out loud about it. And then when we come back after hiatus, we'll have talked about what we decided on as our final project or how we were going to finalize it.
Now, we're already 90 minutes into the show, guys. So if you want to stick around, if you feel like you can stick around for another probably 20 minutes before we get through this segment. You guys good with that?
Yep.
Absolutely.
All right.
Good to go.
Okay, so let's start off. I want to start off with Jeff because he sent his ideas around and he had some questions. And Jeff, you were talking about, you were asking about the orange that I had used.
Absolutely.
So explain your idea and then go ahead with the question.
So the cocktail that I'm working with is called the Boulevardier. Essentially, this has 3 ingredients. It's bourbon or a rye whiskey. It's Campari, which is a really bitter orange liqueur. Right. And it's a sweet Rosso vermouth, which is it's essentially like a fortified wine, more or less. They add some extra alcohol before the wine is fermented so that it has a very, very sweet red wine finish. Bourbon flavor is pretty easy to get. I can put bourbon-soaked oak chips into the mead after it's done fermenting. Let it sit on those for a while and get that flavor that I want for the bourbon character. The Campari that I thought I would get some advice from you as to how you got the orange flavor into that the orange ale you sent around, because if you recall, to me that had a very like reminiscent of Campari
Did we drop Jeff?
Right flavor. That was very pleasant.
There he is.
Would go good to meat, I thought.
Yeah, now, you're kind of.
Was basically to.
Yeah, you're kind of cutting in and out there, Jeff. It sounds like you're in a windstorm.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay. How's that?
That's much better. The orange component, a couple of different things here. The bitter out of that orange ale that I had sent around, part of that came from the hops. There is another part that actually does come from the orange peel itself. If you've ever chewed on an orange peel, you'll know why. But I dropped, I believe it was just the orange part, not the white part, just the orange part of the peel, zest into the last 5 minutes of the boil. Now there's another way that you can actually get it on secondary, I believe. You can even do it in the boil too if you wanted a more of an orange bitter, and that's to leave some of the white part on the peel. Not a lot, but it will certainly intensify the bitter orange. If you leave some of that white part. So, and then you had another question about the wine, about a sweet wine.
Right. My approach essentially to do the vermouth part of that was to basically to start a mead and get it pretty close to alcohol tolerance. I was thinking around 12% alcohol by volume, finished out, fermented, whatever. And then at that point, add some of that wine concentrate so that I have a little bit of the wine flavor getting fermented, but for the most part being left essentially undisturbed, a lot like how they would do a fortified wine. So that a lot of that raw wine character kind of gets left over. And I was thinking, you know, the easy way to do that is just take a can of the that Alexander's wine concentrate, add some or all of that to the mead as it's getting close to being done with primary, and go from there. My question really was, as far as what kind of flavors people thought would be a good complement to, you know, the bitter orange and the bourbon, to make a good, you know, vermouth aspect to the mead.
I think Shiraz. Because of the spiciness. Yeah, the Shiraz, you know, you're typically used to tasting it dry, but think about the spicy character with the sweetness still left in it. I think that would go good with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I thought about approaching this in two different ways. I definitely think that Syrah or Shiraz, same grape, two different names, would be appropriate. I've never seen a can of Shiraz or Syrah concentrate. I know you can buy kits, but if you don't want to go down that route, you know, you're left with a few more. I don't want to say basic, but a few more stalwarts, you know, in the wine. I would say that of what's available, you know, maybe maybe a the Merlot might work well. The Merlot concentrate. You know, if you wanted to be, I'm trying to think, you know, I wouldn't go as light as like a Zinfandel. I don't know if I'd want to go as bold as maybe a Cab. I think another way you could think about skinning this cat, if depending on how creative you wanted to be, was you could take a bottle of say Shiraz and create a reduction on your stove. You know, you could create this red wine, you know, Syrah reduction, and then add that in the way that you would add in, you know, a tincture or something else to really bring that intensity and sweetness. to your alcohol tolerant mead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That actually that could be a little bit easier too.
Yeah. Sergio, a while back, it's been quite a while ago, Sergio had sent us, I don't know if it was on this show or the other show, bottles of wine. And one of them was this black, I don't know, like black currant, black this, black that, berries, and a little over the top for me. So what I did is I took that bottle and put it in a pan and reduced it just a little bit more than half. And actually made a glaze out of it and put that glaze on a pork roast, which came out amazing. So, Ryan's idea about reducing it, I would probably start there.
Yeah, that gives me a lot more control as far as the final flavor, too. I mean, at that point, it's finding a nice wine that I like and not kind of taking a chance with a concentrate that's a reasonable price that I'm not going to break the bank on.
Well, you had mentioned something sweet. You said you were looking for a relatively sweet and complicated red wine concentrate. I don't know that you're going to find a sweet red wine concentrate, but I mean, my first thought was something along the lines of muscadine. That's very sweet. And I thought, well, why don't you just add a bottle of wine? I thought, well, maybe that's not the best idea either, because I was thinking port wine at that point. And then, Ryan came up with it first. He mentioned the reduction. I think that's the best way.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I'm not sure that I'm going to get something that is both sweet and complicated. And really, I can take a complicated wine that I like and just have the sweetness coming from the honey residual. So. That does seem like a more direct, more controlled way to approach this.
And, Aaron, you, I don't even think I even printed your, oh yeah, I did. I got like a page and a half of, email here from Aaron's idea. You're going kamikaze and Long Island iced tea.
Yeah, it came down to these two. I think I mentioned in the email string, these are two cocktails that kind of bring me back to my college days. And I think I'm leaning more in the direction of the kamikaze. So for those of you listening who may not know what this is, it's a cocktail made with vodka, lime juice, and triple sec. One that really turns out pretty tart and sour with some kind of fruity, citrusy sweetness that kind of stands up to that a little bit. And as I was thinking of how to, replicate this in a mead, I think the first thing, I don't even know if I mentioned this in the email, but the first thing that I'm thinking here is starting off with an orange blossom honey to start off with kind of that citrusy type of a honey base. But how to incorporate some of that sour and tartness. And, I think this is something that I have not had any experience with. And actually, I think Ryan made a comment earlier in the show that he has started dabbling in some sour braggots. Now I will say in the past, I did have some experience brewing a Berliner Weiss with my old college roommate, which utilizes lactobacillus. And I was thinking like a lactobacillus bacteria addition here might be very interesting, at least to start off, with the fermentation to introduce some of that sour profile. And Ryan, I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts in terms of like the methodology and how you've utilized a bacteria like this. What we ended up doing was we put together this Berliner Weiss beer. As I recall, we did not add any hops initially. We might have boiled, a short boil, on the initial brew day, at which point we pitched in that lactobacillus, we stuck that thing out in the Florida heat where it was like, you know, 95 degrees or whatever, because I'm given to understand that the bacteria actually works better in those types of temperatures, and let that go for a few days, at which point, you know, we pulled it back in, put it back in the brew kettle, boiled it to number one, kill off the lactobacillus, but then number two, we added a light hop addition at that point in time. And then after that, we pitched just a normal ale yeast to kind of finish off the fermentation. So, you know, as bringing back to this kamikaze style mead, I was thinking of maybe employing a similar type of approach where, you know, we would start off with the bacteria addition, you know, get some of that nice sourness, and then, you know, I know this kind of is breaking one of the cardinal rules here of mead making, but maybe boiling it at that point to kill off that bacteria, and then finishing it off with an ale yeast, and then maybe racking onto some, you know, some limes, either lime juice or even lime zest in the secondary to kind of achieve, you know, achieve that tart fruitiness, even more so with the limes. I think this is also one that I would probably want to finish off with, you know, kind of like a semi-sweet level of residual sweetness. So, you know, I guess the first question I'd throw out there to the group or maybe even specifically to Ryan, you know, the process as I just described it, is that similar to how you've incorporated like a lacto or Brett in your sour braggots? And if not, is there anything that you've done differently?
Sure. So, you know, I'm going to make this really quick just because we could do an entire show on sours and bacteria and wild yeast. There's the two most common bacteria are Lactobacillus and Pediococcus. And they are hops are preservative. The point, hops were originally used as a preservative, and those two can't handle much bitterness, many IBUs. And so a lot of times when you're using those, you know, you're not using a lot of hops because the hops will inhibit their growth or their you know, their effect on the beer, it'll just essentially die off or not activate. So, you know, when you find beers or things like that, they are typically, if they're hoppy, they're dry hopped, you know, afterwards. Now, what you're describing is called kettle souring. And what happens in a kettle sour is you first sour the wort with a bacteria, and then after it's, soured, you then boil it and you kill off the bacteria, and then you'll inoculate, you know, with your Saccharomyces yeast. Brett is also used in sour beers. It is a Saccharomyces, so it's not technically a bacteria, it is a yeast. The way I do it is quite different. I do not kettle sour. When you kettle sour, you essentially are left with something very tart. And if that sounds like what you're going for, so that is what I would do. When I'm making sour beers and sour braggots, I am doing it the more, not anything wrong with kettle souring, but more traditional method of using the bacteria or the Brettanomyces to work on the must or the beer or the meat at that point long term. So those are typically, you know, there's fast acting varieties that might be 6 or 9 months, but some of these might be, you know, 2 years, 3 years. You know, there's a brewery in town that I had a sour beer that they made, a 7-year-old sour. You know, that and as what happens over that amount of time is whether you're using lacto or PDO or Brett,
it develops and concentrates and makes the flavors more complex. So it's not that it's necessarily tart. I mean, and most people think sour equals tart, and it can, but it doesn't have to. It can also be something very, very complex and have a lot of different flavors that, with tartness not being the puckering lemon, you know, Sour Patch Kid flavor that you think of. I said I wasn't going to ramble, so I'm going to stop there. We can talk a lot more about sours later.
Stopwatch is going.
for what you are talking about, yeah, a kettle sour will give you something very, very tart that sounds like what you're going for. And yes, you'll have to, at that point, boil just to make sure you're stopping any of that bacteria activity.
Well, thanks for the input. I think this may be something I'm on to here. I think I coined this the kamikaze mead in the email string there. So maybe something we'll have to add to the brew list.
I think to wrap Aaron's ideas up here, I would use lime zest. I wouldn't put lime juice in. But I think if you want to get the most bang for your buck and get a real honest-to-God lime flavor, use the zest. That'll give it to you, I think, more than just adding lime juice. Same thing with the lemon. If you wanted to put lemon zest in, I would use that, not the juice. Blackberry mojito-ish. Chris, what do you got going on, bud?
Well, I had two ideas. One was the blackberry mojito, and one was a mint julep. The blackberry mojito would be rum, blackberry, lime, and mint. So basically, you're going to make a semi-sweet mead, probably in secondary. Then you're going to add a small amount of blackberries. You don't want to go overboard with it. Maybe like a half a pound, which is something I don't normally do. I don't normally put fruit in secondary, but since this is simulating a cocktail, I think it would be appropriate. Maybe some rum-soaked oak cubes. Choose a honey that's going to lend itself to that molasses flavor. And a hefty dose of mint and some lime zest in secondary. Pretty straightforward there. The other one is really straightforward also, which is a mint julep, which is bourbon, simple syrup, and mint. And sort of the same thing, only we're going to go with some bourbon oak cubes. And I think it would take a lot longer to age it to get that bourbon quality.
I can't believe you're going to go out and buy a bottle of bourbon.
I'm not at all.
That sounds good.
My idea with this was not to try to recreate a cocktail, but to just, you know, go in the same vein as the cocktail, but still keep it a mead, strictly a mead. Sure. And to do that by leaving out other liquors and just strictly making it with mead. And manipulating the flavors either by honey selection or oak aging or whatever the case may be.
So, I think you should do both of them.
I don't know. I might.
I mean, they both sound good. Any particular...
Yeah, and you know, this Metafoam honey that we tried tonight would be good for both.
Yeah.
Because it's got a heavy vanilla aspect for the bourbon, the mint julep, and it's got a molasses quality. So maybe even the buckwheat for the blackberry mojito. I mean, the buckwheat. Yeah, the buckwheat honey.
Sounds good. Ryan is going down. Ryan's taking us back to about 1958 with his. He's got a very classic cocktail, Sidecar. Even and another one that's probably even more classic is the Tom Collins. Who did we lose? Did we lose Ryan?
No, I'm here. Aaron dropped off.
Okay, go ahead.
So, yeah, I thought about two different directions here. The first one is the Sidecar, the classic cocktail made with cognac, lemon juice, an orange liqueur, you know, like a Grand Marnier or Triple Sec. And then it's commonly served with a little bit of a dusting of sugar on a martini glass. If I went this route, I was thinking of starting out by making a fairly high ABV traditional, maybe around that 15% mark, letting it finish with just a hint of sweetness, not trying to get too sweet. And then in secondary, adding some of those cognac barrel chips that we picked up from Label Peelers, some lemon juice, and then some dried, because I have some dried bitter orange peel, and letting that work for a little while, maybe a few weeks, just to see how that goes and have that. The other direction I was thinking was either towards a French 75 or a Tom Collins. Both the French 75 and the Tom Collins pretty much are about the same. Before we get any people that bartended for part of a summer in college at Sneaky Pete's, I'm not saying they're the same cocktail. I'm saying they started out as the same cocktail. Or the base starts out the same. They both have gin, lemon juice, and simple syrup. The French 75, then, you put in a champagne flute and top with champagne, while the Tom Collins is generally, put in a highball over ice with some club soda. If I went this route, I was thinking about the same, again, creating a traditional, a little bit higher ABV, letting it finish a little bit sweet, and then secondary, adding some gin barrel chips, maybe even just some juniper in there, maybe a little lemon juice, and then carbonating it, just like you'd get, out of that, whether it's the champagne from the French 75 or that club soda with the Tom Collins. I put all my thoughts out there. I told you guys a little bit early what I was thinking of. I'm going to sit back. Just if any of you guys have any thoughts or advice on either of those two directions.
How are you going to incorporate the juniper berries?
Well, I would, if I went that route, I would just drop them in secondary for, I'd taste it until it got to about the right strength.
I think you got a hell of a plan, just like you got going here. Why would you use Aaron kind of brought it up in his too, but why would you use lemon juice and not lemon zest?
Well, it's probably the wrong answer, but it's more abundant, or it's easier to use for me, or easier to get. I've had some good success using pure lemon juice in the past, as opposed to zesting a lemon and, buying some lemons just to zest. Again, that's a little bit more of ease than maybe best way of doing it. But that's kind of where I went the first time.
Yep, Chris. I think there's
I haven't had good luck with citrus juice or citrus pulp. I have found that I get more flavor from the from the Zest alone. But with that said, I've pretty much reached a point where I'm trying to stay away entirely from citrus because it hasn't worked out the best for me in any of the batches I've made. I am going with a little bit of lime zest in the blackberry, but with some hesitation.
You're going to soak your barrel chips in some gin or just use the ones that come stock in the bag?
I was thinking of just using them right out of the bag. You know, I think though they will give off some gin flavor without having to soak them. And I'm not at that strength of, you know, where I'm going to be, you know, north of 10, 12, 15%. I'm not concerned about necessarily trying to sanitize them ahead of time. You know, they're clean coming out of the bag, or enough that a full strength mead's not going to have any trouble with anything on it.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Jeff, got anything to add for Ryan?
Well, you know, I've not done a lot of citrus in meads. Recently I did a little bit of an experiment, with a ginger mead that I didn't think had a lot of flavor to it, where basically it was already done. It was already back sweetened and it was already stabilized. I'm not back sweetened, stabilized, what I meant to say. And I just put some lime juice in it to see how that, you know, worked with the ginger, and it worked out pretty well. At the end of the day, I feel like that's a little bit more like using a cocktail mixer than actually incorporating it into a mead. So I don't know how well that applies to this situation, but I go back and forth as far as using zest versus using the actual juice.
Okay, cool. Well, I sent out my idea, and I've sat down and have redone this thing probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 times. It started out as just a mango, then it was just a pineapple. Now it's a mango pineapple. And then I think I had coconut in there, and then I took the coconut out. Well, I put it back in, so now it's mango, pineapple, coconut, rum, ale, braggot. And this is an inspiration. My wife and I have been on, I don't remember how many cruises all over the place, Mexico, Caribbean, Alaska, everywhere. And one of the drinks that they used to, you know, serve on the pool deck, you know, with the live band playing and everything, was they would come around with these trays filled with glasses filled with like a mango, some kind of tropical fruit slush, and then the top quarter of the cup, you know, was empty. So they're only, you know, like 3/4 of a cup full. And then they carried around a rum bottle, this big rum bottle. And you'd get whatever flavor, whether it was mango or pineapple. Some of them had a layer of 3 different kinds. And then you select a cup that you wanted, and the guy would just top it off with rum. And so that's my inspiration for this. However, I'm going the braggot end. So, and this is I converted my leftover recipe into this with the 2 pounds of liquid light malt extract. I bought this 3-pound container of amber, sparkling amber, just because I like the way it sounds when I was at the brew shop the other day. So I thought, well, I'll just throw that in there too. I'm going to use 5 pounds of honey. I'm going big on this one. This is a 5-gallon batch, so we're going all the way with this. So I'm going to put some lactose in it because I need that sweetness, I think, to come out. You know, to have that kind of, because these drinks had kind of a creaminess brought on by the slushy fruit, blended fruit and everything that was in it. Some Citra hops. I think it'll add a nice citrus-like bitterness, hop aroma to it. And then when I get it over into secondary, it's going to go on. Now, these are just random. Well, they're not exactly random. I did a little bit of research and looked at what other people were doing with these ingredients. But 3 pounds of chopped mango, 3 pounds of toasted coconut, 4 pounds of pineapple in secondary. And I'm going to use my other secondary. I'm not going to put it in a glass jug. And then an entire bottle of rum will go into it. So 750 milliliters of rum. I really want that rum flavor. And then 3.5 ounces of rum-soaked French oak. Going to use SO5 yeast on it. And that's my idea. So there you go.
So my question is that these drinks that you're trying to replicate, you know, are fruit drinks. Sounds like, you know, fruit and ice and rum. Yet you're making a braggot, you know, with malt.
Yep.
So tell me about why you decided to make them a braggot, you know, using malt as opposed to just a melomel.
Because I had a tangerine beer that I really liked. It was just one of those things. You're walking by the shelf, but I couldn't even tell you if it was Bevmo or Total Wine. But the wife sometimes likes to get these singles off the single shelf, something she's never had before. And so she picked one and I picked one. I just happened to pick this tangerine thing up. And I thought it was pretty darn good. I really liked it. Had an ale quality to it. Tasted like tangerine. And so that was kind of that's where my head was at when I was putting this all together. Now, you know, I may tone down the pineapple and mango because I don't want it overly. I don't want it to taste like this fruit thing that I had on the cruise ship. I just want those flavors to come through, you know, to kind of remind you. If you've ever had one of these drinks, it remind you of that.
Got it.
So that's my deal. So, and I was thinking about that coconut thing that you had, and everything that I read, you know, people putting coconut in their beers and whatnot, they're not putting ounces, they're actually putting pounds. And I've some recipes that I've seen went from anywhere from a pound and a half all the way up to 4 pounds of coconut. Some even add toasted or the shredded coconut into the boil. Of course, you'd have to put it in a bag because that would be a god-awful mess. If you've ever boiled coconut before, but I don't want to do that. I'm just going to put the coconut in the secondary. So. But that's my idea.
Excellent.
Everybody awake? We lost Aaron. Aaron, get Aaron. About
the IPA. Sorry, that's me. That's Jeff. I'm losing you, apparently.
Go ahead.
So what this is making me think of, though, is with regards to the fruity kind of frozen drinks, with my IPA braggot, I discovered something kind of by accident. I don't remember exactly what kind of grains I had as the steeping grains, but they were there to give it more of a head retention kind of a thing. And when I went to hop it, when I went to carbonate it, I kind of overcarbonated it, but it gave it such a thick, creamy head that I think would be, with a kind of like homage to that fruity frozen drink that you're going for, kind of an overcarbonated, very thick, creamy head, kind of like a Guinness or something on nitro, for example, could be really interesting here.
You know, I had a
really give it a kind of a texture.
Yeah, I love the word. I like where you're going because those drinks had this creaminess to it, and that's why I wanted the lactose. Besides that, I wanted a little bit of that sweetness. But I also put in a half a pound of flaked oats because that also adds some creaminess and will also head retention. They use flaked oats in beers for head retention also. So I was kind of thinking about that as well.
Yeah, I remember.
Go ahead, Chris.
The tropical fruit and the malt portion, the beer portion, in combination, that's somehow, I'm not imagining that. I can't picture that. I don't know. I'm afraid that's going to clash, but it might be great. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there just so I can say I told you so if it doesn't work out.
Sure. I know that. Well, hey, you know, I mean, this is you know, we were supposed to come up with an inspiration from a drink that we've had in the past or a cocktail or whatever. And hell if I know. This is just an idea. So
it's the fun of finding out, you know.
And the malts are like, you know, 2 pounds. This is the leftover stuff. I've got that 2 pounds of light malt extract, which isn't going to add a whole lot to it. I've got that 1 pound of Pilsen, which may add a little bit of flavor to it. And then this amber, probably going to have a little more of that malty component, but it's only 3 pounds. So as far as the malt goes, I've got, about 6 pounds. So what you would find in an average beer kit, usually, about 6 pounds of malt. So I don't know. I mean, you might be right, but I keep going back to that tangerine beer that I had, which I thought was amazing. And I should probably go see if I can find it again and get another taste of it so I can remember all the components that I tasted. I was a little concerned about the hops, you know, because I had those Chinook hops that I bought for that other leftover project, and I thought, nah, I don't think that's going to match up with what I got going here. Started looking up hops, and this Citra has some citrus qualities about it that will add to the pineapple and these tropical fruits. So, but hey, we got plenty of time to think about this. You know, between emails back and forth and whatnot over the next week or so. We can also talk about it on the next show and kind of narrow this whole thing down. But right now, we're kind of giving our audience a bonus session here tonight because we're way past where we should have ended the show. And I think, guys, we're just going to drop it right there and, again, want to remind the audience that we're going to be on hiatus for about a week. We'll be back on June 20th here at the Mead House, and we'll talk more about the cocktail inspired project that we've got going. Also want to catch up with Jeff on his MacGyver like brewing equipment. I think that's going to be a heck of a good segment there. Plus we'll go more into that DIY project. And You can go to the website. It's actually an inline carbonation system that I found quite interesting, quite doable, and I think would be a whole lot more reliable than this force carving thing, rocking the darn keg back and forth on the floor, 40 pounds of foot. So, but anyway, with that, I think we're gonna cut on out of here, guys, and call it a night. We'll come back here in a couple of weeks. And we'll do it all over again, June 20th.